This is an ABC podcast. The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello there. Good you could be part of the hour, the Country Hour, today. A little later in the show, we'll talk about the first alternative meat company that's gone public on the United States Stock Exchange, and the punters have gone wild for it. And do you know what keeps CEO of Australian Wool Innovation, Stuart McCulloch, up at night? Well, it's about wool demand. That's what keeps him up. And he's particularly concerned about, well, Brexit, for one thing, and some of the financial trouble that some of the other European countries find themselves in. So we'll talk about that demand situation going forward and also put to him the Wool Producers Australia a proposal for a 10-year plan for the wool industry and to be driven by Australian Wool Innovation. We'll see what Stuart McCulloch thinks about that. That's to come here on the Country Hour this afternoon. First up, though, fueled by China's insatiable appetite for Australian meat, mutton prices have hit a new high. The National Sale Yard Mutton Indicator is now sitting at a record 547 cents a kilo carcass weight. The previous record was set in May 2017. Now, if you don't follow these prices really closely, just to give you some idea of how high 547 cents is, the running five-year average price for mutton is about 390 cents per kilo for this time of year. Meat and Livestock Australia's Adam Cheatham thinks prices will stay high, but warns the weather over the next few weeks will have a large impact on the market.
So on Tuesday, we saw it hit 541 cents per kilogram carcass weight, and it actually increased further on Wednesday. So we've seen, you know, a relatively strong demand from global markets, which is driving it, and also potential concerns of supply moving through into winter.
So what's it sitting at the moment, Adam?
As of today, it's sitting at 547 cents per kilogram.
547 cents a kilogram. What's been the main driver behind that? Is it people stocking before they expect a winter shortage?
Some of the numbers we've been looking at more recently is the potential for a shortage into winter. It's not set in stone yet, but given the high rates of turnoff that we have seen through the first 6 months of the year, there's perhaps an expectation for lamb supplies and sheep supplies to decline through winter. But also we've seen extremely strong demand from global markets, which has driven over the hooks prices higher, particularly from China, which has continued to absorb a lot of Australian mutton through the first quarter of the year.
What's your expectation then, Adam, that we'll see that figure do, given that there is that shortage, that winter is approaching? Will that average continue to climb?
Yeah, it's a difficult one to predict, to be honest. You know, given the expected short supply, it's expected that prices will find support. However, how the season tracks over the next few weeks, if we do see that autumn break, there's a number of variables which would play into this. But certainly there's an element of price support for the next few months. Whether they will go any higher is still an unknown. Last year, we saw prices obviously peak a little bit later in the season. So if this is the early peak, we might see them come off. But there's an expectation for support in the next few months.
In Western Australia, what are we seeing from the sale yards when it comes to mutton at the moment?
WA actually had a stronger start to the year than eastern states. So the WA mutton indicator actually averaged 20 cents higher than the eastern states indicator for the first quarter. So since April, what we've actually seen is a little bit of a turnaround, and the eastern states indicator has gained a bit more strength. So that there's been a slight change, but WA indicators are certainly robust at the moment also.
Can you give us an indication as to what that WA indicator is sitting at?
Yeah, of course. So at the same time on Tuesday, when the eastern states was at 541 cents per kilogram, WA mutton indicator was trading at 462 cents per kilogram. So a 78-cent deficit.
Do you expect that gap to close, given that shortage that we're seeing, that increased demand? Are we likely to even things up a little?
Yeah, I mean, historically, when we look at the differential between the two indicators, WA has typically traded at a deficit. However, again, depending on the season, depending on how the season plays out in both the East and the West, there's a potential for some price movements, but certainly there's an expectation for both sides of the country to have price support.
Do you have concerns about sustainability in the longer term of these markets if there is a shortage of supply and there is this increased demand?
Yeah, I guess that's something that we would be a consideration. I think what we have to put in perspective is we are, you know, one of the largest producers of sheep meat globally in terms of an abundance of supply. What we're seeing at the moment is global demand is really the driving force, which is potentially, you know, driving prices higher. I think, you know, domestically, if we can see an improvement of conditions, there's certainly intentions and there's certainly the requirements from producers there to maintain a relatively stable flock. So I think at the moment that the driving force behind the prices is really the demand that we're seeing for Australian sheep meat.
Adam Cheatham, he's a senior market analyst with Meat and Livestock Australia, speaking to the ABC's Joe Prendergast. 11 past 12. Now, let's go to the wool industry, because the CEO of Australian Wool Innovation says he supports a 10-year plan for the wool industry, but it should be driven by the industry, not AWI. Stuart McCulloch says it's okay to have a 10-year plan, but with technology in particular changing so quickly, the plan really needs to be dynamic and perhaps assessed every year just to make sure that it's still relevant. And he's not convinced having a document like this is really going to be the deciding factor in keeping growers in the industry or attracting new players. He says that's going to come down to the dollars and cents, the price of wool. Stuart McCulloch, the national wool clip is expected to be the smallest produced in 95 years, down 12% to 298 million kilograms. Now, that's largely due to the drought in the eastern states, but it's also fallen here in WA, down 7%. What challenges does that present to the wool industry?
Well, I mean, you know, we've largely had static supply for the last 8 or 9 years. It's sort of sat pretty even for that period, and we've had good demand, so prices increase. But, you know, this drought is widespread, it's vast, and we're certainly suffering from it. And I suppose the challenges are really the competitive land uses when it does rain. You know, the wool growers these days don't just do what their father did or their grandfather did. These kids coming out of school are spreadsheet savvy, fiscally savvy, and they're taking a hard look at every square acre and what it can yield for them. And I suppose the worry that we have is getting those production supply figures back up post this drought, and thinking of strategies around that to try and help wool growers get back into it. Certainly the price at near on $20 a kilogram is reasonably attractive, and that gives us some confidence that when it does rain that they will turn back to growing those flocks.
What do you say then to Wool Producers Australia calling again for Australian Wool Innovation to develop a long-term strategic plan for the wool industry, say a 10-year plan, and I guess really to attract those next generation of farmers to kind of jump on board with the wool industry? As I said, they've got the choices now and they do shop around and look for the best options. And a lot of them are choosing even sheep meat over wool because they've sort of got that strategic longer-term plan than the wool industry does, according to Wool Producers Australia. What do you say to that idea?
Oh, look, you know, wool producers, I note, have called for this. Actually, the review of performance last year called for it. And, you know, we've had pretty decent discussions with wool producers and the other industry bodies about this 10-year strategic intent document. And, you know, we're currently writing a 3-year strategic plan for the next 3 years. That's for this company. We believe, and they agree, actually, that this 10-year plan should come from the industry. It should be separate, you know, it should be supported by AWI, and absolutely we would do that.
But not driven by AWI?
Look, the reviewer performance actually states that the industry should form this up. We've had those discussions with wool producers and the other industry bodies, and they all agree. We had a meeting in January, an industry consultative committee, greater industry consultative committee, and they all agree that that should be formed up by them in council with us, of course, and we would support that both fiscally and with human resource support. So, look, we're all for it.
But why wouldn't you initiate it and drive it, though? Why is there that reluctance?
That's exactly what we did as part of this strategic day in January. That was a big topic for the day, and everyone agreed that we would get on and do that. Look, I think having a 10-year strategic plan is a good thing to have, and we will certainly do that. But I think the most important thing for these wool growers is getting a yield per square foot, per square acre of land, and keeping wool prices up where they are puts us in a decent position to get them back into the game. I think a document will be interesting to them, but won't be the deciding point between keeping them in the game or out of the game. I think come down to absolute dollars and cents.
So just to clarify your position on a 10-year plan for the wool industry, you're all in support of it, but you don't want to be the driving force. AWI doesn't want to be the driving force in it, even though you collect levies from each and every wool grower that could go towards that.
Look, the actual industry believes that this should be formed up. You know, I don't know whether you want me to say, we're going to drive this, write it and do everything, but we don't think that's the right way. We think this should be done with industry. It should be championed by a group, and I presume that we will do that, and we will fund it and, as I said, support it with human resources. But this was something that was unanimously agreed to by the industry, including wool producers, that this should be formed up with them and other industry bodies. And we would certainly support that, and we would take that as the industry 10-year strategic intent document.
So how important do you think a plan like that is in terms of addressing supply concerns? Apparently, according to Wool Producers Australia, there are concerns from China about the future supply of wool going further. It could also identify research and development priorities, things like that. What do you think would be included in that sort of plan?
It should be a rangy document that has all sorts of the research component to it. It should have marketing. It should have a vision for agri-tech in Australia and in the wool industry in particular. It's a big thing. I suppose the challenging, especially with things like agri-tech, the challenging thing in that space is we're largely dependent on the, places like Silicon Valley and those tech companies and human health innovation being applied to animals. Everything's moving so quickly these days that it's going to be to have optics on that 10 years out. I mean, if you look back 10 years, the smartphone is just over 10 years. The first iPhone is just over 10 years old.
And so it had to be a really live 10-year plan.
Yeah. Oh, look, there's no doubt it'd be dynamic, but having optics on things that are 10 years out is becoming more challenging in every industry simply because machine learning, technology, human health and animal health medicines are moving so rapidly that you've got to be able to pivot. And that's going to present some challenges in writing such a thing. But, it can always be a dynamic document that's addressed on an annual basis. Certainly our strategic plan, our AWI, Woolmark strategic plan, is something that is revised or tweaked every year.
Considering the sort of numbers and the wool clip with the situation the industry is faced with at the moment, how concerned are you about supply into the future? And are you hearing those sort of concerns, with our major buyers too, with China, for example?
Oh, look, we don't look at one side of the ledger. One side of the ledger is supply. The other side is demand. And, I've got real concerns actually about demand in the Northern Hemisphere. We have a number of very important customers to us that are under, real fiscal pressure and slowing growth. And that's one of my things that's keeping me up at night at the moment is demand. Now, supply is down. There's no doubt about that. Supplies are rather predictable. It'll be down by 12% or a bit over 12% this year. We'll probably lose another 4% next year simply because there was no lambs. what we've got in the Northern Hemisphere in terms of demand is we've got a whole lot of issues. There's Brexit, all the major banks in Italy are in trouble, Germany's in trouble in terms of growth and could go into a recession. We've got a trade war between China and the US. Japan's still not going so well. I mean, these are major customers for us. Now, whether that demand is negated by the drop in supply, I don't know that, because supply is predictable, but demand is not always predictable. I'm kind of looking at that horizon of those economies overseas, and I think we've got to look at it from both sides of the ledger, demand and supply.
So is the wool clip exactly where it should be then, considering your concerns about demand going into the future?
Oh, no, no, I would never say that, something like that. We want to see more growers in this business. You know, we've, as I said, we've had flat supply for the last 8 years and really good demand. And if you can stimulate or have demand slightly above supply, then the price goes up. We don't think it's appropriate where it is. We'd like to see more wool growers back in it or growing their flocks when they do get rain. But, you know, you can't simply focus on supply. It's a demand and supply thing that drives price up, and that's the real game, is getting the price up as high as it can for those people that are in it.
Just before I let you go, Stuart McCullough, a couple of growers have mentioned this point to me, and I just wanted to run it past you just to see how you make sense of it. Here in Western Australia, so a specific state issue, wool production, these are figures from Australian Wool Testing Authority, down by 7.2%. But then in AWI's Beyond the Bale publication, the population, the sheep flock here in WA, the current flock, 15.1 million, and that's up from the year before, 14.2, and the year before that, 13.6, I think it was, 13.6 million. So how do you make sense of that, those figures, that the sheep flock increasing here in WA, but the wool production down by 7.2%?
Oh, I presume it's a yield thing. You know, cut per head. But I'll look at those figures and ensure that there's a sanity check on them. But I'm sure that they would have been well checked.
Yeah. So it's just down to yield. We're just not getting the wool out of the number.
Well, I think so. I'll also talk to AWTA about that and make sure that we're all singing from the same hymn sheet, or a delay in those figures. I don't have those figures with me at the moment, but
yeah.
I'll certainly have a look at them because prima facie that could look peculiar, I agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, thank you for letting me run that past you. I just wanted to do that because I have heard that a couple of times. Good to talk to you today. Thank you so much for being part of the Country Hour.
My pleasure.
Stuart McCullough, he's the CEO of Australian Wool Innovation. 22 past 12. We'll stick with sheep for a little bit longer because the Pastoralists and Graziers Association is calling on federal Labor to clarify its plans for the live sheep trade. Labor has already made it clear that if elected, it will suspend the live export trade during the northern summer. But it's unclear whether Labor will support the existing three-month ban between June 1 and August 31, or seek to extend it ahead of the five-year full phase-out of the trade. PGA President Tony Seabrook is calling on Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon to answer these questions, just to give industry and voters greater certainty.
At a press conference that Joel Fitzgibbon gave a few days ago, he talked about a summer shutdown, and he didn't in any way enunciate what that might encompass, whether it's the 3 months or further. And the last thing in the world that this trade needs right now is more uncertainty. Now, there are multi-million dollar ships, companies, there's a whole raft of people very heavily involved in the trade, and ambiguity or uncertainty is really a bad thing right now.
I've put in a request to get some clarity on this from Mr. Fitzgibbon, but it's been reported by other media that a spokesperson said that Labor would likely, and I say that quote-unquote, support a ban from May to October. What do you think the ramifications of that decision would be?
Look, there are an awful lot of people in this supply chain. It's not just producers. There are livestock carriers, there are the people that supply them with tyres, fuel, insurance. There's a whole raft of other businesses tied around transport, and then you get to the pellet manufacturers. You can't actually tell these people to hold their breath and hope for the best. Many of them have made commitments, large financial commitments, and they're obligations that can't be stepped aside from. And when you've got financial outgoings and no income, very damaging. And I don't know whether Joel fully understands the implications of an extended shutdown. Then there's the market. I mean, you know, we have Kuwait, which is one of our largest trading partners. They're totally dependent on livestock from Australia, and they were devastated by what happened last year. They can't understand why. They've made an enormous commitment, you know, $100 million on a brand new abattoir, and I was there for the opening of it a few months ago. You know, there's a lot at play here, and it's very easy to be cavalier in the remarks that you make without considering the implications. We're heading towards an election, and political parties will often say whatever it takes to get them over the line. Joel's a very reasonable man, and I have floated this before, and he has said that he will stay the course on the policy they've taken. But the question that we will ask him, if he is to be the next Minister for Agriculture, is a very, very loud why. You actually have to have a reason to do something, and the question of why would you do this? The changes that have been wrought within this trade, and there are many, but the lower stocking densities would probably be the key one, also the shutdown for 3 months, are coming forward with some absolutely exemplary figures on losses. Heat stress is a different argument, much harder to measure, but mortality on a two-tier boats are supposed to be banned from the 1st of January. The mortality on the last two-tier boat that I know about was 0.2%. This is a spectacular result, and so I would say to the Minister, if you are going to do something, you need to have a reason, and we need you to enunciate what that reason is likely to be or what it is. So that question of why, Joel, why would you need to do this, will be at the forefront of our argument. Everybody understands the disruptive nature of a three-month ban, massively disruptive, but we've accepted the fact that we need to do whatever it takes to make certain that the outcomes are the best possible. When the federal minister indicates that the ban may last for longer than 3 months, there will be a point where people throw their hands up in the air and say, look, we really want to do this, but you've just made it that little bit too hard. We cannot contain or maintain our staff, our business model, office, you know, everything involved in live export, where we are not allowed to operate for an extended period way beyond the 3 months.
Pastoralists and Graziers Association President Tony Seabrook with John Daly. And it's been reported in the West that a spokesperson for Joel Fitzgibbon says it was likely Labor would, and I quote, support May to October as the northern summer in which sheep would not be exported. We have put in a request for an interview with Joel Fitzgibbon. We haven't received a response at this point. We've also requested an interview on this with Labor's candidate for the O'Connor electorate, Shelley Payne, and she declined. Liberal member for O'Connor, Rick Wilson, says he believes the people of his electorate deserve answers.
Look, it's disappointing because the live export trade is so important to the electorate of O'Connor. WA exports about 85% of the nation's live sheep exports, and, you know, probably 70% of those come out of my electorate of O'Connor. So, really important issue for the farmers across O'Connor, but not just the farmers. The people that have been, you know, most seriously impacted have been the truck drivers and the people that work in the ancillary parts of the industry, such as feed lotting and feed pellet manufacturing. But obviously the flow through will hit farmers, you know, very hard. Obviously, the Labor Party's position on the live export trade is of serious concern, and I guess the first person that the farmers across my electorate and others involved in the industry would turn to would be the Labor Party candidate. So, you know, whether, you know, she wins this particular seat or not, I think it's incumbent on her to explain the Labor Party's position. Now, one of the things that I was asked when I did a roadshow a few weeks ago was what exactly does a five-year phase-out of the industry looks like? Is it an end date? Is it a winding down of the industry? I mean, these are the sorts of the questions that either Joel Fitzgibbon, the shadow spokesman on agriculture, or the candidate for O'Connor need to explain to people across my electorate.
Member for O'Connor, Rick Wilson, with the ABC's John Daly. It's 28 past 12. Still to come, talking to you about the first of, well, perhaps many mobile abattoirs that's been built right here in WA, in Perth, and possibly coming to a farm near you. Now, the idea with these mobile abattoirs, it's an animal welfare issue because obviously that the cattle or sheep, whatever, don't have to travel on the back of a truck to the abattoir. It can be done there on the property. So there's that animal welfare issue of things, unless some kilometres being travelled too. Tell you more about that after 12:30 today. Just before the news headlines, though, this is something we were talking about on the Country Hour yesterday, about Wesfarmers wanting to get into mining. The retail giant, the conglomerate, specifically has its eye on the electric car industry. Wesfarmers has offered nearly $780 million for the lithium miner Kidman Resources, which has the Mount Holland lithium project out near Hyden. Now, the deal looks like it will go ahead, but is it a good one? Craig Parker is the Senior Director of Corporate Ratings for S&P Global. He's responsible for Wesfarmers' credit rating, and he says any investment in resources comes with substantial risk, but he thinks there's also a lot of potential for growth.
We still treat Wesfarmers predominantly as a retailer, but having strategic investments in opportunities that will provide a higher growth potential than simply owning the retail businesses.
You mentioned they're a retail entity, but they're now breaking into the resources industry. What are some of the benefits and equally pitfalls to this move?
So from a credit rating perspective, we look at the sort of the dark clouds, because we're trying to determine what could cause pressure on the balance sheet of a company if it's involved in a resources sector such that it has end market volatility. And I think, I suppose, the view that we have is that this investment relative to Wesfarmers' balance sheet is quite modest, and it's an adjunct to their strong exposure that they have in the chemicals business already. So this is a way that is consistent with their operating strategy of growing the business and growing it into potentially a higher return business, but that with that higher return you also have higher risk. But we believe, because of the size of Wesfarmers' scope of activities and its balance sheet, it can accommodate this moderate investment in the lithium market.
Yeah, is there some risk there though?
Any greenfield development has substantial risk. You know, risk of ensuring that you get the adequate grade of material, that the processing facility performs as you would have expected, that you don't have energy outages that cause disruption to your ability to deliver the product to counterparties that are relying upon a stable supply of product to support their manufacturing facilities. So the risks aren't immaterial, but in the context of the size of Wesfarmers in terms of its balance sheet, it can be accommodated.
S&P Global Credit Analyst Craig Parker there. 12:28 on the Country Hour. Jonathan Beale has the news headlines for you.
Thanks, Belinda. Labor's election candidate for Melbourne has quit over offensive online posts. Luke Creasy had been under pressure to stand down after online posts emerged showing he made derogatory and lewd comments about women. Mr. Creasy says he made the awful comments many years ago and they do not reflect the views he holds today. Scott Morrison says the dumping of another Liberal candidate shows the coalition won't tolerate extremist views. Jessica Weiland quit today over online comments she posted attacking Muslim people. She insists the Facebook post was doctored and is still asking the federal police to investigate its origin. And the leader of an animal rights group has pleaded guilty in the Mandurah Magistrates Court to three charges of trespassing after he broke into a piggery in the southwest. 25-year-old James Warden live-streamed his actions on social media earlier this year. He's pleaded not guilty to stealing a calf and a dead piglet and aggravated burglary and is due back in court in July. More news coming up at 1.
Thank you for that update, Jonathan. 12:27 here on the Country Hour. And still to come, tell you more about that mobile abattoir that's been built here in Perth, and it could be the first of many that are going to come to a farm near you. And also that first alternative meat company that's gone public on the US stock exchange, and a lot of interest in it. And the price, quite impressive, for a debut. That's to come here on the Country Hour. Right now it's off to the Weather Bureau. Matt Bodehoven has the details this afternoon. Matt, as always, let's start in northern and eastern parts. How's it looking?
Yeah, afternoon, Belinda. Over the next 4 days, it's fairly quiet in the northern and eastern parts. On Saturday and Sunday, we'll see showers and thunderstorms through the northern parts of the Kimberley, contracting mainly to the coastal parts on Sunday. And on Monday, very isolated showers and storms around the northwest Kimberley parts. Showers also creeping into the southern goldfields and the western Eucla there on Monday and along the Eucla coast on Tuesday.
All right, well, let's move into the Southwest Land Division and see if there's much rain in the front that's coming across. Was it Saturday, Sunday, something like that anyway, Matt?
Yeah, a little bit, and there's a couple of fronts coming through. So on Saturday, we've got the cold front moving over the Southwest Land Division during the morning and early afternoon. Showers will be in the central and western parts, up to 8 millimetres possible in the southwest and up to 5 in the lower west, and up to 3 millimetres possible in the southern parts of the central west there on Saturday. On Sunday, another cold front will approach and reach the southwest district in the evening. Showers southwest of Lyon, Perth to Albany, increasing with the front in the evening, up to 10 millimetres in the southwest and up to 5 millimetres in the lower west. On Monday, the cold front will weaken and move into the Bight, and in the wake of the cold front, a ridge of high pressure will build over the Great Southern and the Southwest districts. Showers extending throughout in the morning, then contracting to areas south of Aline, Perth, Islay Bay in the afternoon, up to 5 to 7 millimetres in the lower west and southwest, 2 to 5 millimetres in the Great Southern, and up to 12 millimetres in the south coastal. On Tuesday, the ridge of high pressure will continue to build over the southern parts of the Southwest Land Division. Showers possible south of Aline, Mandurah, Islay Bay, contracting to the south coast in the afternoon and evening. Mainly light falls, and the falls likely to be less than 2 millimetres.
And warnings this afternoon, Matt?
Just got a strong wind warning for the Albany coastal area.
Great, thank you for the wrap. Appreciate that. 24 to 1. The rainfall figures now for the state for the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, checking 5 mils and over, and only 5 mils and over in the Kimberley. Allan Bray, 31. And Wyndham Aero 22, no rainfall over 5 millimetres in the Southwest Land Division.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
And I'm very glad you are. Denny Burkett along just before the news at 1. He'll be going through the wool market and the wool market up, the Eastern Market Indicator and also the Western Indicator up this week. Denny will go through the details very shortly. One of Australia's first mobile abattoirs has been built in Perth and should be processing cattle on farm before the end of the month. Now, one advantage of doing the job on farm is it helps farmers control the quality of their meat. And there's also no need to transport the animals from the property, of course, and that has obvious benefits, especially when animal welfare issues hit the headlines. And as Michelle Stanley reports, it won't be long before you see one of these mobile units popping up in your patch.
It's been a long time coming. For more than a decade, producers have been considering and researching ways to cut down food miles and improve animal welfare with in-house, or should I say on-farm, slaughtering units.
This, from a farmer processor perspective, is what I call the holy grail.
Chris Ballage heads up the Victorian ag tech company Provenir, and about a year ago it commissioned its first mobile abattoir, and it's just arrived.
I'm a scientist by training, farmer by choice, and I've been producing premium quality meat for the last 7 years under my own label, which was a paddock-to-plate label. But I always had to have the meat processed at the abattoir and having to drive the animals an hour and a half and 150 kilometres to the abattoir. I could see the stress that was incurred by the animals, and that was a really strong motivator.
A mobile abattoir is exactly as it sounds, a slaughtering facility on wheels. From the outside, it just looks like a big old truck. But inside, it's quite a bit more than that.
So the unit will arrive onto farm. So that's, we call it the MPU, or the mobile processing unit, will arrive on the farm. It integrates with the farmer's cattle yards. From there, the animals are put into a small holding pen, and then they're led into the back of the truck where the knocking process occurs. And we've got a fairly unique knocking box, which has got quite a bit of technology adapted to it to, again, minimise the stress for the animal just prior to slaughter process. From there, the animal goes through the normal processes of the abattoir, so there's dehiding, dehocking, decapitation, evisceration, and then the carcass is halved. And at that point, the animal is transferred into another unit that is sitting alongside the MPU, which we refer to as the RV, or the refrigerated vehicle. And the half carcasses are loaded into the refrigerated vehicle, at which point, at the end of the day, that refrigerated vehicle returns back to the further processing unit where the carcasses hang for an additional couple of days, and then they go through the butchery process into the retail-ready product that we will distribute.
With only a few of these units understood to have been built in Australia, it's not your simple flat pack to put together over the weekend. Perth-based manufacturers Simmons Global were commissioned for this unit, and they had to engineer each piece from the ground up. Chief Executive Dave Simmons described it as trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. But one of the trickiest parts of units like this actually comes from Australia's strict food processing and transport regulations.
So we're taking something which is a mobile piece of equipment, so road regulations, trafficable trailers and things like that, and all the engineering that goes to that, which is fairly straightforward and largely been done before. And then we're taking a set of regulations being the abattoir specification, which has been built for a fixed facility.
And that means it's not cheap. We're talking millions of dollars worth. Neither Chris Ballage nor Dave Simmons would put an exact price on it, but there are at least seven figures.
There's a lot in it. Simple things like hygiene, taken for granted in a fixed facility, but in this sort of environment, it is a costly and challenging pursuit. There's also things like potable water. Very simple when you're on a scheme water supply, but when you're taking potable water, you've got to have quality assurance on your water. You've got to have traceability for all of those aspects so that you can have a quality product at the end of the day. So there's all of these aspects that have been built into and are largely hidden in this particular unit that make it a very costly thing.
This unit has been sent east. It's going to be used on properties around the New South Wales Riverina. There are five more slated for production, though, one of which should be stationed in WA's southwest. But instead of producers doing it themselves, Provenir's business structure is to buy the cattle from the properties and slaughter them under its brand. But it isn't designed to travel far, just between properties up to about 40 kilometres away. And it also has a limited throughput of about 10 to 12 head per day. So if you're a producer sitting on a property thinking of going it alone, is this viable? Chris Ballage and Dave Simmons say maybe, but it's certainly not going to be for everyone.
It comes down to the cost of transports and things like that, the cost of maintaining traceability of your product, and if in fact that's a brand for the property, there's significant value in that. And the thing that has excited us about it, we're a company that generated from a regional beginning, and we do a lot in the ag space, and it was great to see a project or a development in the space that allows growers and producers to capitalise, I guess, on the fruits of their work, because when they send their cattle off to the process of meat processing, they get a certain dollar rate for that. They have costs and on-costs for transport, for feed lotting and things like that, whereas if they can do all that on their own property and there is no need for that, then that means that there's an economic benefit, which means our farmers are getting more money for their produce.
Dave Simmons, he's the CEO of Simmons Global, ending that report from Michelle Stanley, talking about that first, or one of Australia's first mobile abattoirs being built here in Perth. But as you just heard, heading east, well, this one is anyway, but it looks like a few more on the drawing board, on the production line. So we might see one around here in the southwest, as Michelle was just telling you. A few comments coming through on the ABC Rural Facebook page. Michelle has popped up a link to the story there. Tim says, great idea. Will they do sheep as well? Cut out the middleman. Tim, the answer is yes, it could be configured to process sheep. Alison says, what about biosecurity issues going farm to farm? Steph, as a meat scientist, I wonder about how credible the claims that the mobile abattoirs improve the quality of the produce for a number of different reasons. Not that I'm against them, says Steph. Would just like to see more science behind claims before we hijack people's emotions and perceptions. But Karen has responded saying, Steph, at a minimum, it will cause less stress for the animals than live transport and live export to a dreadful death. Leave your comment on the ABC Rural Facebook page, or you can text through 0448 922 604. Salty Matt says, food miles. Doesn't the mobile abattoir have to drive to the farm and then the processed meat also then have to be driven away? Two trucks show up. That's double the food miles by my calculations. It's a bloody great idea though. So sort of a tick, I guess, from Salty Matt. 1:45 here on the Country Hour. We will get to the wool market details just before the news at 1 o'clock. But before we do that, there's a company called Beyond Meat that's made its debut on Wall Street overnight, becoming the first alternative meat company to go public on the American Stock Exchange in what's been described as one of the biggest IPOs since the global financial crisis. Shares in Beyond Meat closed at a whopping $65.75 a pop, which values the company at around $3.8 billion. To get an understanding of how significant this is for the alternative meat industry, Matt Brand spoke to Matt Ball from the Good Food Institute.
I think Beyond Meat's IPO and its success is extremely significant. And Beyond is really the first of its kind, first company of its kind to go public. It's a new type of food company. And they're making plant-based meat for everyone. They're not just targeting vegetarians. And that the financial markets recognize the potential here, and it really changes the game for all other startups and anyone looking to get into this space.
Were you expecting this company to close on day one at $65 a share?
Oh, no, I was not expecting this at all. I mean, 2 weeks ago, they were thinking that their IPO price might be between $19 and $21, and they were only going to offer fewer shares, and then they increased the number of shares they're offering, and they increased their target range. And then when they priced out last night, they priced it $25. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And then I had the stock ticker up, and it just went crazy. I had absolutely no idea. It was totally beyond my wildest dreams.
And I guess full disclosure before we go any further, you didn't fork out any cash, did you?
I did not. I might be able to retire now if I had gotten ahead of the curve.
Why do you think investors were so keen to sink their teeth into Beyond Meat?
Well, I think the potential upside for Beyond Meat is just enormous. I mean, their sales continue to grow and grow year over year. They're basically only limited by their ability to scale up their production. So getting in on the ground floor of what could be potentially be an absolutely ginormous, just an enormous global food company, that's very attractive to investors.
What is Beyond Meat's plan?
Well, I think Beyond Meat's plan is just really simple. And first of all, they need to expand production to meet the growing demand for their products. And then they just want to continue to introduce new products and improve on the products they already have.
I've just watched an interview with the chief executive of Beyond Meat, Ethan Brown. He told CNBC that the company really isn't focused on the plant-based meat sector as much as it's focused on the meat sector itself. Now, if you were a cattle producer, a traditional meat producer, what would you read into that comment?
Yeah, I think that this is just another way of saying that Beyond Meat wants to make products that everyone loves and everyone wants to eat. mean, they aren't simply targeting people who are looking, are going out of their way to look for a plant-based product. I mean, they want to sell to everyone. This is why Beyond sells in the meat aisle of grocery stores and not just the meat alternative section of natural food stores.
A few of the cattle producer forums that I've been to this year in Australia, the question, the topic of what gets called fake meat, it always comes up. In Australia, I know cattle producers have been told not to worry and that there will be room in the market for traditional and alternative meat products. What do you think?
I think that there will be for as long as I can imagine. And right now, plant-based meat is less than 1% of the market. So even growing at the rate that Beyond Meat is growing and other plant-based meats are growing, and it takes quite a while to get further up in the percentage of the market. So I don't think that companies like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods are the boogeyman. I just think that it's part of the overall change and evolution of agriculture.
Matt Ball, he's from the Good Food Institute. It's a not-for-profit organization based in the United States, which promotes plant-based and cell-based meats. 10 to 1 here on the Country Hour.
This week on Landline, is it a bird? Is it a chicken? No, it's a quail.
We're going to be processing 5,000 a week. We're going to be, no matter what.
Also, we travel more than 2,000 kilometres visiting outback roadhouses and their unique owners.
My coffin's there. I'm going to die at 100. We'll have a party for 3 days while I burn away.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
Very shortly before the news at 1, we'll give Danny Burkett a call and find out just how strong the wool market was this week. It is doing very well at the moment. But one woman who's keen to promote Australia's wool industry to the world is Chantelle McAllister. Now, Chantelle's originally from Brisbane and she started seeing a wool grower's son. Then she joined his shearing team and became a wool handler. Then she had a child. Things got a bit busy, of course, and she had to take a step back from the boards. But Chantelle is a keen photographer. And she's now travelling throughout Australia taking photos for her Truth About Wool campaign.
I've always loved photography. My dad's one. I've always had a camera. So it started out just more of a documentary for myself of this world I'd stepped into that was so vastly different to my life in the city. And this is showing my age a bit here, but it's sort of when Facebook first came out. I wanted to show my friends and family, show off to them a bit as well, like how cool my life was. So it sort of started out as that. And then the more I worked in the industry and photographed it, I had more of an in-depth look and it sort of sparked a deeper passion for what I was doing.
So can you explain to us what it is you're doing now?
At the moment, I'm travelling with my partner, still with him, Jace, and our 13-month-old baby, Travis. We travel with his shearing team and he shears at different properties through the southern states of Australia. Meanwhile, I photograph all the different properties we go to I'm running a campaign called The Truth About Wool. So it's getting positive imagery out there and honest, raw stories of the people in wool, the properties, the sheep, how wool's grown and harvested, just to give people more of an inside look behind farm gates and woolshed doors to how it's all done, because woolsheds are not really sort of easily accessible, especially to urban areas. You have to sort of travel a long way and gain access to them. So I'm sort of want to give a peek inside to our wool and give more of a broader understanding of it.
We're sort of in that day and age where animal activism is quite prevalent. I mean, do you feel like what you're doing here is going some way to counteract that?
I do. I sort of feel like when it comes to animal activism, I don't want to just defend ourselves and be like, no, we don't do that. No, it's not like that. I think it doesn't really achieve much. So I think when people are educated in wool and they know exactly what goes on, if anything else is sort of fed to them that is untrue or is inflated a bit, they can sort of lean back on that knowledge and be like, well, actually, I've seen it and I know what happened. So I think it, in a way, it is sort of pushing a bit back against animal activism, but it's not the reason why I do it. It's sort of just a happy little side effect, I guess.
Now, you've recently spent some time in Western Australia in some of the biggest wool sheds in the state. Can you tell us what that was like out in the Nullarbor?
Well, first of all, the Nullarbor was nothing like I expected. So I've never travelled it and I didn't really research it. So I just assumed it would just be like these flat sand dunes with nothing growing on it. But to my surprise, there actually was. And driving into Majura Station, just to get my head around that it was 2 million acres, and I come from a sheep property in southern Queensland that's 2,500 acres. So the first couple of days, I couldn't really get my head around it until I went up. I was offered to go up in one of their planes, go mustering. And it was so surreal, and it just blew my mind. Being in the wool industry for, it must be 11 or 12 years now, you sort of sometimes think, I know everything there is to know. But I learn every day. So it's this massive operation. Like I had a big sense of pride to be part of an industry that we can run such commercial flocks that produce such amazing wool, but then it still comes down to that they are so successful because it's that real personalised care for each individual sheep. My passion will always lie within the wool shed and telling the stories of, well, everyone along that wool pipeline.
Photographer Chantelle McAllister with the ABC's Tara de Landgraft, and we have put a couple of Chantelle's photos up on the ABC Rural Facebook page if you would like to have a look. And one of the comments there from Jeff says, Chantelle Ray Photography is a wonderful advocate for the reality of the wool industry, where the vast majority of growers, shearers and others in the industry are very ethical and concerned for the well-being of the animals involved. Yes, there are a few, very few bad eggs, but this is the case in any industry. They are few and far between. Catch up with that story. Have a look at the photos on the ABC Rural Facebook page. 1:04. Let's get into the wool market details now. The market was up this week. The Eastern Market Indicator up 17 cents to close at 1,960 cents a kilo clean. And the Western Market Indicator also up 28 cents to close at 2,093 cents a kilogram clean. Danny Burker, what were the market details this week?
We had a positive tone through all three centres over the 2 days. In Fremantle, 18 micron lifted 35 cents clean, closing at 23.25. 19 microns also up 35, closing at $23 flat. 20 microns up 15, 22.60 for the close. 21s and 22s up 20 and 25, closing at 22.50 and 22.35 respectively. If I take that back to the farm gate, Merino fleece wool, sound, 68% at 185 kilo. 18 micron will return you $2,925 a bale. 19 micron, $2,895. A 20 micron, $2,840. 21, $2,830. And a 22 micron, $2,810. Pieces and bellies up 30 to 50 across the board. So that was a very good result for 2 weeks running for that particular market. Had oddments with locks, stains and crutchings up 30 to 40 with lambs remaining par. For the week for the three centres, we actually cleared just over $82 million, which adds to the $2.8 billion worth of exports for wool for this year. And Western Australia contributed just shy of $21 million to that this week. If you did sell wool over the floor in Fremantle, taking the average across all types, including crossbred wools, $2,190 a bale. So a very good result, as I said, through the three centres, in particular here in Fremantle.
All right, let's go through the buyers. Who was there this week, Danny?
TNU took the top buying position for Merino fleece wool. They took 3,842 bales, roughly $9.5 million worth of capital just in that particular segment alone. Tech Wool Trading, 16% just behind them. Then PJ Morris, 11%. Fox and Lily at 8%. Interesting, TNU, as I said, top buyer in the fleece. They're also right up there. Merino Skirting's the third buyer, taking 17%. So a market dominated this week by TNU, who have been there sitting in the wings week in, week out. But it's great to see a market lift that 35 cents clean without one of our major buyers sitting in the market. So extremely positive as we look forward into the coming weeks.
And for next week?
We have only, for all the listeners that subscribe to this is a supply-driven market, well, if that is the case, then we should have an extremely healthy market next week. Sydney, Melbourne and Fremantle offering 33,464 bales. The following week, 34,000 and a half. The following week, just 30,000. So as I said, anybody that subscribes to the theory that this is a market driven purely by supply, then we are set for a position which could see this market have another rally. If it is the supply issue that has driven us to this point, we are just shy of 200,000 bales in arrears in offering from this time last year. So a significant quantity of wool that hasn't hit the market simply due to the drought in the eastern states.
Danny, thank you for the wrap. Appreciate that. Danny Burker with the wool market details. Earlier we were talking about a company called Beyond Meat making its debut on Wall Street overnight, and the punters loved it, closing at $65.75 a pop. The company valued at $3.8 billion US dollars. This through from Graham. Beyond Meat, making plant-based meats. My sheep do that for me. Thank you for that, Graham. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.